École normale supérieure, savoir en multimédia.
Thank you very much for Joel and Tiziana for inviting me to this colloquium seminar conference. And this talk. And I'm really glad to come back to Paris and give a talk here. Actually, I came back here like in 2009, I think. A few years ago, I came here as to give a small informal talk, and I'm so glad to be back and just share my idea with you again. And today, I'm going to overview my profile of research, mainly on the cognitive science and developmental side, and the cross-cultural study I'm recently starting. So as a background, my research interest, my passion is to study human social brain. So why it is interesting, why it is important to study human social brain? Because there is a theory in the evolutionary biology that the human brain, the enlargement of a human brain in the course of evolution, it could be like a part, at least partly contributed by the adaptation to the large group size, like the society. There are two lines of evidences behind this theory. One is the relative size of primate brain is best explained by the species group size. This is a cross-species anatomical studies, and then there are several predictors, and then the best predictor to predict the size of the cortex of each primate species is the size of the groups they are living in normally. And of course, as you know, as a cognitive working in the cognitive science, that there are several like brain regions, like cortical regions, subcortical regions. They are specialized to process social information. I don't say they only process social information, but they are optimized to process the information which is adaptive to live in the social world. So this is my interest. However, to study social cognition, there are several big challenges. One of the biggest challenges I always feel is that the social environment is really fluid and rapidly changing. So you have to make an online decision in a very noisy, complex environment. So to do that, you really require very fast and spontaneous processing of the social information, not a slow and deliberate one, which don't really catch up with real conversation, real lifetime online information. I don't say this reflective process is not important, but one critical aspect of like social communication is this real, rapid, online, spontaneous nature. However, I have been having a problem with when I'm studying like using experimental psychology technique, because they often use this more slow and deliberate and explicit instruction, and we really ask them like what they best can, what they can best when you give them enough time and space to really think about and get to the solution. But in real life, you are not really given the amount of time you want to make a best effort. So you have to. So it doesn't really fully catch the nature of real life social information. So I've been working on several ways to find out the spontaneous, like rapid, fast social cognition. And today I'm going to share with you some of the study I've been doing. So today I'm going to talk about like two major steps and one newly emerging area of research in my profile is the cross-cultural. First, I'm going to talk about babies, young infants, and then I'm going to talk about autism. In each talk, I'm going to show you several examples of a study I'm doing, which I hope is catching this fast and spontaneous nature of social cognition. Then I want to share with you some of my recent efforts to see the way to study the one aspect of development, what is the effect of postnatal environment on the development of social cognition. So from infants, I'm going to start with the talk about theory of mind, which is a very popular concept, probably most of you are familiar with the concept. This is the ability to attribute mental states to self and others to explain, predict other people's behavior based on the mental states. And children below the age of 3 don't always pass the explicit type of false belief task, like very popular Sally and Smarty type of task, which in which like we show them the puppet story that then we ask them to answer the question. Then to correctly answer the question, they have to understand that the people can behave wrongly, incorrectly, because she didn't see the object being moved in her absence. However, these children age below three, like 18 months old, and in the most recent study, like the 7 months old, can pass a version of what we call spontaneous false belief test. So what is it? In typical sequence, as in infant science, infant watch human actions in the video presentation or in the live presentation, which induces false belief to a protagonist. And we, instead of asking children questions, because as you know, that you can't really ask 7 months or 6 months baby to answer the question verbally. So what we do is we measure their spontaneous behavior, and we mainly focus on oculomotor behavior, like looking time or like eye movement using eye tracker, because oculomotor system is the earliest developing motor system in the humans, because you can't rely on manual motor system to respond until much later in the age range. So since 2005, there are like numbers of papers published which are consistently showing that this infant spontaneous response at least take into account the factor that the actor's behavior could be based on her false belief, like what they have seen, what they have not seen, and what they may know, what they don't know. So I'm going to share you one of the study which I examined to this idea with using blindfold study. So this blindfold study consists of two parts. In the first part, infant experienced this pair of like a blindfolds. I'll show you the detail later. So there are two sets of blindfolds, and each baby experienced only one of these two. One is opaque blindfold, blinding blindfold. It's like a normal blindfold. If you wear it, you cannot see. The other condition is that I call trick blindfold, which looks like blindfold. It's exactly the same. It looks exactly the same as opaque blindfold from the distance. But when you really wear it, put it very close to your face, you can actually see through. Then infant observed the object being moved when the actor wore this, what I call blindfold. So this is an image of training session. What we did is we play with the baby, 18-month-old baby, and what we do is that we show baby a toy, and when baby look at the toy, we put a blindfold in front of baby's face, and we repeat it again and again for up to 5 minutes. And baby like this play, and they can tolerate 5 minutes. And by the end of the day, so we expect the baby to learn the property of the blind, but whether they can see through the blindfold or not. And then the baby watched this. And this blue dot is the point of one baby's eye movement, fixation. And this is what we presented on the video to the baby. And critically, the baby in both groups saw exactly the same test movies. So this is the anticipated sake, the number of the baby who made a correct sake to this left side, hand side window. So then this is the differential looking time, the difference between the looking time to this left side of the window and right side of the window. And for those baby who experienced opaque blindfold, their looking time behavior is clearly biased toward this left-hand side, the location the actor last saw the object being hidden. So it suggests that they are expecting that the actor still look for the left side of the box, because this is where she last saw the object being hidden, and she still thinks the object is being still there. But the baby who experienced the trick blindfold, they didn't really show that behavior. They performed rather by chance, not different from the chance. So they are not really attributing this false belief. They are not anticipating that actor do the same action, even though they saw exactly the same visual sequence in the test event. So this study clearly showed that the baby learned something about the blindfold, and they used that knowledge about the blindfold to anticipate other people's behavior. So the another critical part is when babies themselves wear the blindfold, they cannot observe other people wearing blindfold and doing some like long read. So the only way they can transfer the first person experience to the third person action is through the some understanding of perceptual access, perception. So this study clearly showed that the baby are using the baby are attributing perception and perceptual access to others based on self-experience to attribute belief or predict action based on the perceptual access. I'm going to slightly different type of study which we studied gaze following behavior, because it's another critical social behavior in humans. So this is a slightly vague question, that is the gaze following behavior social? Here we asked whether they always follow the gaze as in automatic manner, or their gaze following behavior is dependent on whether the person behaves in a communicative way or not. So in this study, 46 month old babies, 10 in each condition, watched object direct gaze of adults while their gaze direction was continuously monitored using eye tracking method, as in previous study. And as a measurement, we measured whether infants actually followed the other's gaze immediately after her head turn, so the first direction of socket, we called it. And the number of like gaze alternation between the face and object is also counted, how many like checking behavior they are doing, and whether they are looking longer to the particular object over the other object. There are always two objects in the screen. And for each score, we calculate a different score to see whether there is a bias to like orient to the object being looked at by the others over the other object. So this is a sequence of the stimuli which always start like this, the lady looking downwards, and then after one of the four conditions, she always look at one of these two objects in a random way. In half the trial, she look at the left object, and in the other half trial, she look at the right object. In the first communicative ostensible condition, the eye contact condition, the lady made a clear eye contact to the camera, to the baby, before making gaze, object direct gaze. The non-eye contact condition, she didn't make eye contact, but I actually added some colorful animation on top of her face just to catch baby's attention to the face. In the third condition, we used exactly the same visual stimulus as in this second condition, but we added auditory communicative signal. A lady saying, like in an infant direct speech tone, pitch control, like saying hello to the baby. In the fourth condition, we control for the voice factor by using the same lady, same volume, same words, same length, but in the flat adult direct speech tone, like saying hello. And this is the result. In most of the measurements, you can clearly see that in this eye contact condition and in this infant direct speech condition, they are looking behavior, like the first direction of socket, the frequency of checking behavior, the duration of the fixation, especially here, all biased toward the object being looked at by the actor. So they are clearly following the gaze. But in this non-communicative, non-ostensive condition, like non-eye contact condition or adult direct speech condition, their looking behavior is roughly the toward the chance. So they are not really biased to look follow the gaze. So this clearly suggests that this gaze following behavior in 6 months old infants are not the kind of automatic reflexive behavior, but they are actually conditional behavior based on the presence of preceding communicative signal, at least this age range at this condition. So we followed up this idea to see whether actually baby is actually coding that event that the baby someone is looking at the object or not. Whether they are coding the relationship between the direction of the gaze and the location of the object. And we show them the adults, both adults and 9 months old, and
whether they observe what we call referential or non-referential gaze. I'll show you the example later. And in the behavioral study, we found that actually 9-month-old bias, they perform differently between the referential gaze condition and non-referential gaze condition. They tend to look longer to the referential condition than the non-referential condition event only when this referential gaze precedes the period of eye contact, come communicative ostensible signal. So this is an example of referential gaze. Whenever the flying fish appears to the periphery, she always looks at toward the object. So she her gaze always refers to the location the fish was previously appeared. And this is a non-referential gaze, and this is the same time sequence, but this lady is always looking away from the gaze. So to discriminate these two events, they have to encode the relationship between this gaze direction and the location of the object. And today I only show the ERP results to see whether their neural signals differentiate these two events. So this is the adult result. We are clearly seeing small but significant difference between the neural response to the non-referential object incongruent gaze and the referential object congruent gaze. This object incongruent gaze elicits larger negative component in mainly the occipital temporal area, which kind of replicates previous fMRI studies showing that this non-referential gaze, like object incongruent gaze, elicits larger activation in posterior sperm temporal sulcus or inferior parietal sulcus. And in 9-month-old babies, we replicated the findings. So apparently, they are doing similar things, computation as the adults, at least like, as far as I can see from this ERP results. So their component, negative component is larger in response to object incongruent gaze compared to object congruent gaze, encoding these things. But recently, we are finding other people are reporting the result that similar posterior component difference can be found when you're seeing arrows or like some human fingers pointing. So it may be showing that there are some like violation of expectation type of response. But more interestingly, we found this frontal component which showed opposite result. That this object congruent referential gaze and elicit much larger frontal component compared to the non-referential gaze. But this area is also replicated in other detection of eye contact or like an infantile speech. So it may be the case that this signal relates to this infant preference or infant and attention to this ostensive communicative signals and the referential signal which follows it. So to summarize my line of infant science, this 18-month-old infant spontaneously anticipates other person's action based on her mental state, at least mental state. I don't know whether it's belief or not, but at least a mental state and opaque mental states. And 6-month-old infants, they follow gaze not random, automatically, not obligatory, but they follow the gaze only after the ostensive signal, such as eye contact or infant direct speech. So I think that it is optimized for referential communication. We don't really know what is the computation, what kind of computation is happening, but functionally, this kind of conditional response serves as a detection of ostensible referential communication. Then, by 9-month-old, we are seeing that these infants clearly encode the referential relationship between the gaze and the referent. They are not simply following the gaze and finding the object, but they are encoding the event that someone is looking at something or not. So these examples clearly highlight this infant's spontaneously encode social information in the lab setting and respond adaptively, respond with in the way which is adaptive in the real world social communicative situation. So I think this like this infant results clearly highlights that we can really catch the aspect of spontaneous social cognition. And then what I've been doing is using this infant method, bringing this infant method back to the children and adult science to see whether these adults are doing as good as babies to do this line of spontaneous response in the lab setting. So the next part of my talk will be about autism. Autism is very common, although one part is more common than most of these rare genetic disorders. They are one of the most common form of developmental disorders. And it has like societal, economical impact as well as familial impact, educational impact, which is makes autism science very important for the society as well as for the science. And autism is defined as a triad. I know this triad is going to change in a year's time because there is a new diagnostic system. DSM-5 is coming in a year's time, and I know that it's going to be integrated into two domains, one social domain, social communicative domain, and one non-social domain. But still, this social communication and non-social behavior exist as a part of the autism diagnosis from next year on. So one of the major components is the social communicative impairment. So people like me who are really interested in understand human social behavior, we really want to understand why people with autism develop such atypical form of social communicative skills. So from here, I'm going to show you a few examples of our autism studies. And first, I'm going to talk about this false spontaneous false-belief test in autism. This is just roughly the same task as I presented in the beginning. So here we tested adults with Asperger's syndrome and age-matched, IQ-matched neurotypical adults. The most critically, they all pass standard false-belief tests. So when they are asked in the test environment, they can all correctly answer that anticipated behavior based on the false belief. So they watched the same video. This is the previous version of our study, not this particular blindfold study. But the only difference is that the actor looks away rather than wearing the blindfold to elicit false belief context. And we didn't really give them no instruction. We just asked them to look at the stimulus carefully. And then we recorded the eye movement using eye tracker. So this is a critical event. As you see, like she's looking away. Bear took the object. And this is one of the typical adults who is clearly showing this correct anticipatory circuit. And these are the results. Neurotypical adults, they are as good as 2 years old. They are good as 18 months old. They are clearly biased to look at the location, which she would act based on her false belief. However, adults with Asperger's syndrome, by contrast, they didn't really show such a bias. They are looking behavior completely random. But then they can anticipate in more much simpler, like true belief conditions. So this kind of absence of bias is limited to the false belief context in our experiment. So they don't anticipate spontaneously other people's mental states, even though they can do exactly the same task when they are asked, instructed explicitly. This is another line of result, which probably I can quickly skip because the slide isn't really showing very well. But here, what I showed is that this is like eye contact is one of the very clear signal of social communication, as I talked before. And then there is one neuroimaging study showing that typical children show a larger occipital-temporal ERP component in response to direct gaze compared to averted gaze, but children with autism don't show such a response. So they can recognize direct gaze, but direct gaze don't facilitate this posterior cortical processing as in typical developing children. And here we tried to see whether there are gaze behavior, they are looking toward the eyes, may have something to do with the processing of the face. In this particular context, attention to the face. So we just modulated their point of fixation to see whether they modulate attention or engagement to the face in autism spectrum disorder as well. We used what we call like gap, what is called gap overlap test. And this is one overlap trial in which the central fixation remained present when there is a peripheral target, and then participants are asked to suck it towards this peripheral target as quickly as possible. Well, this is an example of gap trial. And the center of fixation disappears before the target appears in the periphery. So usually, the socket latency is much slower in this overlap condition than in gap condition. Because in here, you really have to actively disengage from the face to socket toward the peripheral target. But in the gap condition, you don't have to do this because the object already disappeared. So by calculating a difference in the like, reaction socket latency between the overlap and gap condition, you can estimate the time you require to disengage from the central target. So we measure that this like a gap effect in response to the face target, face fixation, and house object fixation, and in three conditions. In one condition, we just ask them to look at the face. And in the second condition, I put fixation point in between the eyes and ask them to really look at the eyes and attend to the eyes. And I gave another task to make sure that they really detect the eyes. In the third experiment, we did the same thing to the mouth. They have to fix it on the mouth continuously, and they have to change slight difference in the mouth, which happened very rarely, to make sure that they clearly attend to the mouth. And we measured this gap effect. And we also recorded ERP to see whether there are neural correlates, same or different. So this is another weak slide. Sorry about that. So this is like a looking reaction time and the gap effect in the face and object condition in autism spectrum disorder and typical development. So we couldn't see here is the ERP, but I'll focus on the behavioral results. So typical children, their gap effect is larger in the face condition than in the object condition. So the attention can be captured much longer when they are looking at the face. In autism spectrum disorder, they are not different between the face and object condition. And the gap effect actually only differs between groups in face condition, but not in object condition. So apparently they are doing very well, and they are engaging equally well in both face and object, but in typical developing condition, there is a bias to just attend more to the face. And actually, ERP mirrors these results. And typically developing children show like a larger socket latent potential in response to the face compared to the house, but children with autism don't show any difference. And their level of ERP amplitude is roughly the same as the house condition in autism, house condition in typically developing children. And in the second experiment, when we ask them to fixate on the eyes, actually the group difference emerges in autism group as well. It took longer for them to disengage from the face compared to the object, just like the typically developing children, even though the average score is slightly smaller. So it clearly shows that when we instruct them to look at the eyes, and the face capture attention more than before. However, when we look back to the ERP component, what is happening is that it is not different from what we saw in the experiment one. In typical developing children, this like socket latent potential are larger in response to the face compared to the object. However, even though they are showing behavior here, their socket latent potential are not different between the face and object. So when we ask them to fix it on the mouth, this like a face object difference disappears in ASD and in typical development as well. They are just equally the same. And their ERP don't really discriminate between the face and object either. This little query shows that when we instruct them to fix it on the eyes, apparently it is changing some aspect of face processing, attention to the face in this autism group, but they don't really fully normalize the cortical response because you can still observe the difference between the autism and typical group even when you ask them to look at the eyes and when you see apparently similar behavior response, but the cortical response can be different. So this is another example of like how they respond to the gaze. And this is the commonly know the interaction between the gaze direction and facial expression. For typical adults, typical children, and typical infants, they are faster to detect angry face, like approaching emotion face, when they have like approaching gaze direction, direct gaze compared to averted gaze. But when they're observing like avoidant related facial expression like fear, fearfulness or sadness, and they often are faster to detect this facial expression when the gaze are also having avoidant, averted gaze compared to direct gaze. And we replicated that finding in typically developing children that angry face are detected faster with direct gaze compared to averted gaze here. But fearful expression is like detected more faster with like direct averted gaze compared to direct gaze. However, in autism spectrum group, we didn't see any effect of gaze direction on the speed of facial expression process and detection. And we replicated that finding when we only present eyes, because as you see, like the fixation of the eyes may or may not be different in these two groups. So, but we clearly replicate that finding. Even if we only present eyes, that there is an interaction here in typical developing children that they are faster to detect the angry face with direct gaze and fearful face with averted gaze. There are no difference in autism group. And there is a ERP difference as well. This incongruence condition didn't really appear, but yes, typically developing children show a larger N170 component in response to congruent facial expression and gaze direction compared to incongruent gaze. So it's kind of congruency between the facial expression and gaze direction facilitates face processing here. But it is not the case in autism. The last of my experimental slide for the autism study, I'm going to show you how this like a gaze processing, gaze following behavior can be relevant to the word learning, one aspect of social learning. What we did here is what we call gaze contingent stimulus display. So we record babies, children's eye movement using eye trackers, and we presented the stimuli only when children are looking at a particular location of the screen. In this experiment, we presented face in the middle and face avatar in the middle, which isn't really showing, but this is actually here. And there are two objects in the periphery of the screen, like in the gaze following experiment I presented before. Then in one condition, when a child looks at one of these particular objects, the central face look to the same object and the child is looking and at a novel word like Toma and Sefo. And in the other condition, whenever children look at one object or one object, the face look at the opposite object and at a word, Toma or Sefo. And the question is whether children map this novel word to the object being looked at by this central avatar or his own. So this is the result. This is a percentage of trials children labeled word to the target object, the object being looked at by the central avatar, or the opposite object, object being in the opposite direction, or destructor, the novel object which children haven't seen before in the learning phase. So this is a condition when the face followed in baby's child gaze that they look to the same object. This is a discrepant condition in which the face always looks to the opposite object of children's own point of fixation. In the following condition, both children with OSD and typical developing children map the novel word to the object. The speaker focus what attention, so their performance is roughly the same. They always label the object which he looked at and the face looked at. In the discrepant condition, actually, children with ASD are showing like labeling like in about 60% of the trials, But actually, this is much lower than what we see in the typically developing children. So they are still having a bias. They don't always learn the object and map the words to the object he's already looking at. He and the children, they sometimes switch attention and they learn the novel word in most like half the time, but it is not as strong as what we see in the typically developing children. And we also measured how long they are looking at this particular object. So we calculated the different score, like as in before, and to see whether they are following this face gaze in this following and discrepant condition. And the typical in following condition, both groups are looking, following the gaze and looking to the same object longer. But in the discrepant condition, it was only typically developing children who shifted their gaze. And ASD, actually, they didn't stick to the original object, but they just started to look randomly. They are not really following the gaze like in a biased way. And we have been thinking, like, what is a way to make them learn the object in the name in the discrepant condition. And what we did is in both were following the discrepancy condition, when the face look at one object, the object moves, and we just try to add the saliency of this like discrepant or following object to make sure that they shift their gaze, and then the performance just became ceiling. So once we can move their eyes, actually they are labeling the word target. Obviously, they may be using this alternative cue, but they can do this in this particular condition when you will use another like location cues. And they are clearly shifting gaze in this condition as well, even autism in discrepant condition. So to summarize, individuals with ASD do not spontaneously anticipate others' behavior based on false belief, even when they are capable of solving same task when explicitly asked to. And they often fail to spontaneously attend to relevant social signals, like they don't always attend to the eyes. They can do it in some condition, but they don't always do it. And it sometimes hampers their performance. And they can follow gaze. They can shift their attention to the gaze direction, but they don't always do it in all conditions. And in some conditions, it hampers their social learning. But in all the cases, when we add more cues, when we ask them to do this, they can perform that task and in a much better way, but not in the same way as typical adults, but typical children. But actually, they can do many things when they explicitly ask to, but they don't do it in this when we put them in the lab and just ask them to look at the screen. So it is really difficult to conclude what is the mechanism underlying this lack of spontaneous social cognition. But one of the things which I have been repeatedly seeing in several different tasks is that they don't have a bias to spontaneously attend to the relevant signals. But it is kind of very interesting to think about typical development, because we don't tell them typical children what to look, where to look, but they all have a consistent bias. They all have somehow developed a bias to look at the relevant location in the relevant time, but children with autism, they just follow their own interest and they don't follow this norm or shared bias as like many of like non-autistic people have. This is a slightly different line. This is more like a challenge than the compressed result, because I think it's a very interesting way to study the development of social cognition, especially in my interest in spontaneous social cognition. So this is a rationale. Here is a rationale. I really want to know, in the course of development, we really want to know how the genetic plays a role, but we also really want to know how the postnatal environment, like familial or cultural environment, the level of learning play a role to develop social skills. So how do we want to study it? In animal studies, it's very straightforward. You just deprive them of the of the social environment. We just strictly control the amount of social exposure. In like this study by, done by Sugita, actually, he raised monkeys for first 2 years wearing masks. So this monkey saw no face in the first 2 years. Then these guys record the response, first response to the face when they first saw the face after 2 years of deprived life. And it is very clear, straightforward idea experiment, but obviously you don't want to do this with human babies. So what you can do? One way I think we have a chance is we study the naturally occurring variabilities in postnatal environment, because like in different cultures, it's very different. In different families, it's very different. And there are several special cases in which child tend to have a very different familial environment. So this study could be the case. And here I'm going to talk about one of these challenges, exploration, when we study the difference in the cultural normal eye contact and how it changes face gaze behavior. So as you know, even there is a variation within Europe or within North America compared to East Asia, you are all making huge amount of eye contact. And when I talk about here, because then I was commented that you shouldn't really study English because the English don't make eye contact compared to the French or Italian, but even the English make a much larger amount of eye contact compared to Japanese. Because this is a cultural norm, and then this is a critical part. This is not the behavior, it's a cultural norm. And when you avoid eye contact in the communication, in the greeting, you could be perceived as insincere or like hiding something or like not very friendly, which is not the case in Asian culture like this. So when two cultures meet, and sometimes there's some uncomfortable meetings. So there are a few lines of studies which experimentally examine this effect of cultural norm on the behavior. In one study, they compared Canadian and Japanese, and then it is a very specific question when they ask very difficult question, and then avoiding gaze is helps you to concentrate on the questions. And in this case, actually, Canadians maintain a longer eye contact than the Japanese. But when they, even though that avoiding gaze can be helpful to concentrate on the question, this is a real human study, and they used video recordings. And there's another eye tracking study using static image of the face. And actually, they found difference even in this more less natural condition. But here, what they found is that the British make a triangular fixation. They fixate to both left and right eyes and mouth. But here, Chinese tend to make a more central fixation. They fixate in between the eyes on the eyes, and they don't fixate as frequently as British to the mouth. I don't really know what's happening, but apparently these guys are arguing that this has something to do with the difference in the cultural style of processing face. Then I wanted to go somewhere in between. This is one of the many attempts I'm starting, and in this talk, I'm going to show you one study which I examine the eye contact behavior, like eye fixation, in dynamic but experimental context using eye tracking. So we controlled the race, ethnicity of the face, the gender of the face, and facial expression, like communicative or non-communicative, and the gaze direction. And we all used an avatar face, not a real face, because this is the first study. I really wanted to control that all the micro expression in the face, so I don't want real actor to move muscle, at least in the first experiment. So this is one example of East Asian female making communicative action and making direct gaze. In this study, we split the face in 5 different regions, based on the previous eye tracking studies. We used, we put the area of interest in both eyes, and we called one eye as a front eye, one eye as a back eye, because the face is slightly tilted, and one eye always is closer to the observer than the other eyes, which is slightly the sideway behind. And we calculated the bridge in between the eyes because it was showing interesting results in one paper, but we didn't find anything. But we also calculated the area called center in the nose and the mouth. And we measured how long they are looking at each area. Well, this is the result in the front eye. Before doing that, I did like a fully closed ANOVA. And the only interaction we found was the interaction between the culture of the observer and area of interest and the gaze direction. There is no effect of facial, there is no effect of the ethnicity of the face, no effect of the gender of the face, no effect of mouth movement, communicative movement. And there is an interaction with like participant sex, but most importantly, we didn't find any kind of famous other S effect, the interaction between the face ethnicity and participant ethnicity. So we followed up this like gaze direction and cultural background interaction. So in the front eye, there is like a Japanese participant look longer to this front eye in the direct gaze condition than the averted gaze condition. And British did similar thing, but it's much weaker. And that actually, when you analyze by like second by second, it isn't really very consistent. So apparently, Japanese are differentiating between direct and averted gaze condition more than the British participant. It is far more exaggerated in this back eyes condition. So Japanese participant overall look longer to the back eye compared to the British participant. Apparently, this British tend to stick to the front part of the eye, center of the face. And what is striking is that when the face is making averted gaze, the Japanese participants follow the gaze to this back eye direction even more than when they're looking at the direct gaze. But British didn't really do anything. They don't really care whether they are looking at towards themselves or about it, and they didn't really go to this backside of the eyes. And there is another consistent finding that they are looking, British participants are looking more toward the mouth compared to the Japanese participants. It's very consistent. It is consistent with the previous study as well. And a similar trend can be found in the central fixation. British tend to fix it more to the nose than the Japanese. So in a way, we kind of replicated the previous finding using static images that British fixated longer on the mouth. So they are making more like fixation, not triangular fixation, but the fixation between front eye and mouth. And the Japanese tend to fixate longer on the back eye. So they are like doing this fixation like this, like in between two eyes, and British are making like fixation in the horizontal, vertical ways. So we don't know, like previous people said that there are casual difference in the holistic analytic preference. So British tend to European want to analyze the information separately, piece by piece, but Asian want to process information holistically, but it may or may not be the case. And apparently, the Japanese are making more attention to the eyes and then more responsive to the way people move eyes. Like they modulate eye fixation depending on the possible gaze direction, but more than the British did. It's when the Japanese are making moves where British don't. I still don't, this is the first line of research. There's more question than any answer because this is one single study. It doesn't really answer anything much, but at least we can say that we are clearly catching something in this impoverished environment, and which is consistent with the way that European has a cultural norm to maintain eye fixation, eye contact, where Japanese are more have a cultural norm to attend to where they are looking at and just they follow what the other people are doing. So, of course, we have several follow-up studies to see how it develops, how it affects face processing, what is the mechanism underlying it. But this is the first line of research which I hope that can answer a question about the effect of postnatal environment on the development of social response. To summarize, young infants spontaneously process social information and anticipate others' behavior. It is very clear. And by contrast, individuals with autism spectrum disorder show absence of spontaneous social cognition, spontaneous allocation of attention to the social information, even when they are capable of solving the same task and attending to the same direction when they are explicitly asked to. And I'm hoping that the development of spontaneous social orienting, social cognition, seems to be partly modulated by the postnatal environment, such as cultural norms. And to understand the mechanism of this changes through the development, changes through the environment, can give answer to the early development as well as how we can change the development of social cognition in autism. Oh, I had a future direction slide. So this is one big question: what is the mechanisms underlying it? I keep saying I'm describing the phenomenon that they are not doing processing information spontaneously, but I didn't yet point out what the mechanism is underlying it. So it may be that they don't have very fast computation. Their attentional mechanism is not optimized for the social information, or motivational rewarding aspect may play a role. Each aspect has to be really studied, vigorously. And how this innate bias, eye contact, even newborns are oriented to the eye direct gaze, but apparently this gaze processing seems to be changing very drastically in the first few years. So yes, I really want to know there is a practical implication in my study as well. I'm studying children in atypical environment to see what is the impact of this familiar environment. And my main concern, my main interest, autism, what we can do about it from here. So thank you very much for your attention, and I thank all the collaborators, and thank you very much for your time.
I have a question about your position, about your results in autistic spectrum disorders, because in my mind there is two schools. Mm-hmm. The first one advancing that social processing are impaired, actually, and the second one advancing that they have a problem of motivation, but that in this case their process could be preserved. And in your case, I think there is two interpretations, either advancing that implicit process are impaired but not explicit one, or to say that in the case you did not explicitly ask the participants to process the face and so on. If you explicitly ask them to process the face, they can't do it. And you, in this case, you infer a kind of motivation. And when you did not ask to do that, they are not motivated to. So I was wondering whether you think there is an impairment or not.
Okay, this is getting more hot topic, especially in the field of autism. Yeah, it's a very good question. And my position is, this is a very big debate I have been having with teacher last evening, and I haven't yet set my position, I have to say, and it's really an open question. But what I can say is that neither of these, both of these positions are kind of caricaturized and then to the extreme. And from the viewpoint of a developmentalist, none of them is actually viable. I can't really, because both of these questions have similar innativist assumption that this social computation, computation theory of mind, or computation faces, can develop on its own without really external input environment. Because one says that there is a genetic modular impairment of social processing, and other camps say that even though they are having completely different experience because of the lack of motivation, they are still developing secured, preserved modular computation. But I cannot really think brains are so plastic. So if they have like continuously having like different experience throughout the course of life, well, I cannot see how the central computation remains same, preserved, and unchanged by this like whole range of different experience. So my position would be more in not in between, but that there is some like specialization problem that because they have a born with an innate bias, but for the module or like for the computation to be specialized to be fully optimized, this like innate bias have to really interact well with the social environment to get a lot of learning, a lot of like selection of the learning to make sure that the brain finally develops more specialized, capsulized information. So if they have some problem in either in the innate bias or some neural architecture, like they, if they have like much thicker cortex distribution of cell neurons or like more different formulation of like intercortex interneuron communication connectivities, and then obviously they would, their brain should be could not be able to learn the optimal like a fast processing. So their computation can be developed to some extent and can be prompted by some external help, but it's not as optimal enough to process it in a noisy environment, which could be the problem. So that is, I think, the third position I'm taking, and that it is could be the development which really explains the phenomena, the interaction between this atypical overall structure of the brain and the atypical experience it causes in the life. But obviously, this is only a one position, and then these two positions are having some supporting evidence. So, but I'm saying that this, like, another thing is this, like, you can still claim that this motivation mechanism, like, biased attention to the face, biased attention to the mental states, can be a part of module which is impaired. Because, so this is a way how you explain the phenomenon. But what I want to know, see, is like, I want this each camp to generate prediction and test it. And I think they are already doing it. So in few years' time, I think we have more evidence how we contrast this phenomenon and how, most critically, how this different, like explicit and spontaneous processing appears in the course of development.
Hi, Oriel Greenspan. I have a question regarding, like, if in autism also, if they're able, well, there are some impairments in gaze following or joint attention, but when you explicitly give them instruction, they're able to perform those tasks. Mm-hmm. Would it be possible that there would be impairments? I don't know if there are some research on a really bottom gaze control impairments, like really making the link between perception and gaze action, gaze motor signals. Is there like maybe in the loop, perceptive active loop, there would be something deficient?
Yes, there is like several lines of studies, and they sometimes show different oculomotor behavior in some tasks, but not in other tasks. That is always a problem in autism. There are huge heterogeneity, and they are often very specific to the stimulus. And for like one example, one group found that the impairment in the disengagement. So they have one group claiming that their children with autism have a difficulty in disengage from one position to make a generate a socket out from the salient object. But once we studied, once other people start to follow up, as I showed that when we use face, even because this like disengagement was much shorter in autism than in typical control. But when you use the original stimuli, like a colorful moving animation, children with autism make a longer fixation to the particular location than the typical population. But when you use like relevant boring non-social objects like house or cars, and you don't really see any difference. So my question is because when in some experiments you can clearly see the difference in the gaze control, gaze, they don't have overall impairment in socket generation, but they have some impairment in like socket inhibition or cyclin disengagement or anti-socket. They sometimes have that kind of like an impairment, but it's often very stimulus specific. So it's more like how they calculate the stimuli and respond to it rather than how they really control the eyes. So that is my impression that many of these like oculomotor impairment is often specific to the linked to the stimulus, linked back to the stimulus, which makes it really difficult, which is really causing which.
Just a quick question about the mechanism. So if when I listen to your talk, I have the feeling that it's basically all about attention, and it's basically all about the fact that they are not able to like engage using certain cues that we do use. There's another cue that babies are using a lot to learn, which is mother ears and like very high pitch, yep, for instance. So they use two cues, high pitch, yep, or like eye contact. Do you know of any studies in autistic children or autistic, well, we cannot talk about autistic infants because they're difficult to detect, but in autistic children, looking at that, looking at also whether they're impaired at any kind of cues that we would call social cues or whether it's specific to eye contact?
Infant direct speech, I don't know if there is any study specific to it, but eye contact, there are a few studies, and actually there is one study recently published about this, like a baby siblings of autism, who has a high genetic risk, and then this baby who are later diagnosed as autistic or like having autistic traits at the age of 3 tend to show less differentiation between the direct and averted gaze at the age of 7 months old. So apparently there is something happening. But then on the other hand, when you do the eye tracking to these babies, they just go and fix it on the eyes. So it's not like they are not, their eye movement are not optimal, but when they are looking at it, they don't really see the significance of the event, or like their brains are not modulated by this cue. So I think it looks like it's more like detection and salience of the detection of the signals. But that's as far as I can say from here. And I really want to know like what, because I'm just trying to describe the phenomenon that it's more about this, how to orient, when to orient, what to detect, rather than compute this concept. But now that I come here, then because as you said, that there is a very big next question that why they don't orient, and then many people are coming up with the idea that like automatic computation or like motivation, and I'm talking about more like optimality of the computation. But I think it's all next question, and then data is coming, and then I know that more data is coming for the young baby sib study in the next couple of years. But
and from a very pragmatic point of view, I mean, are you thinking about some alternative strategies? I mean, they might be responding to something other than gaze cues, for instance, and maybe they might be learning using those other cues. I mean,
yeah, I think it's fairly possible because they can do loads of learning, so I think their mode of learning is different. And obviously, as you know, that some of the learning can be better done by independently by teaching. So I think they can be better at other form of learning. And if we can really latch on it, and it's going to be a really good way, pragmatic way to really enhance their social learning as well. But I have to identify it.
You finished your talk saying that perhaps you could modify the development of spontaneous social cognition by changing the environment in atypical development. I was wondering whether you have any ideas of where to start. So you're thinking of early re-education, something like that, intervention.
Yeah, that is the biggest question I want to answer before I retire. But so that is one of the reasons why I'm starting specific project to study the effect of postnatal environment, because it's not very straightforward. So one could clearly, most simplest prediction is that if you get less experience, you get less learning, but it's not the case. For example, I didn't present because it's not yet published. I'm studying the sighted infant of blind parents who have very different familial experience of eye contact. And what I'm seeing that they don't show the decrease in gaze processing, but they sometimes show like increase in gaze following in the first few months. So I think there is like a more complex interaction between the innate bias, innate computation bias, and the environment. So if the environment could be impoverished, maybe the brain can like boost up to some point to learn some information. That information could be there, but it is also the case that if brain plasticity is that important in that case, what's going to happen when the brain don't really have this extra capacity? But I'm also hoping that the opposite could also be the case, that even if brain lacks some level of plasticity, some level of bias, but then over-enhanced social information could compensate for it. But this is still a story. Many people are trying to do this, but before doing it, I really need to understand the mechanism, how infant brain interacts with the early social world. Then I'm just starting this line of project. Finally, I got the funding, so yeah. Please wait for another 5 years.
I'd like to ask a question myself. As a follow-up of Sid Quitter's remark about the cues that can be used by autistic children, there was this old study by Jacqueline Nadel,
yep,
called the Still Face Study. In the first bout, the autistic child was exposed to an adult having a face without any kind of expression, called the still face. And at this point, the child doesn't care. Now, if the child has engaged with that person, that is, if they have played together, if they have done something together, and then the adult adopts the still face, the child reacts extremely negatively. So it means that there might be a context that elicits sensitivity to social cues in children with autistic disorder that may be more important than is realized in the present experimental studies, because in those studies, of course, you don't have a history of relation to the child. You are just taking the child as new to the world. Don't you think it makes a difference to this kind of experiment?
Yes. I'm aware of this Jacqueline's still face study, and actually in her study and in the follow-up study, what people are finding is that children with autism approach more to the adults after they are being imitated by the adults than just simply by playing with them. So there are two ways to interpret. One way is this, like being imitated creates a social bond, but another way is that being imitated means that children are in control, they can predict every inch of behavior. So it means that they have created a completely different form of learning, that they can actually control other people. But the question is that, because typical baby often have like a sense of control, because when they smile, baby and mother smiles. When they speak something, then mother often repeats a lot of words, but apparently children also don't detect it as a social enough, but they really need more cue to detect there is something coming, contingent to their own behavior. So I think this is a very interesting question, how they detect social communication from them, because for typical infants, there's eye contact, infantile speech is enough, but people with autism, they don't detect it as a communication. They don't always detect it as a communication, but they may be, as you said, you're still using several different cues to detect some contingency, to detect some sort of communication. So one way I'm trying to address this question is trying to use this, what I call a gaze contingent eye tracking paradigm. In this paradigm, whenever baby look at some particular stimuli, then the stimuli response. So in a way, you can actually create a communication between the children's eye movement and the subsequent event in the screen, or like even the real life human as well. So, and I have one study that this contingency is sufficient to elicit gaze following behavior to the very like abstract object like teapot. So baby start to follow teapot gaze after they saw like an object or teapot always jumps whenever you look at it, but they don't do it if there is no history of this kind of communication. So we can actually recreate that kind of situation in the lab using eye tracking. And I have already have one evidence about it in typical infant, and I'm trying to use and put it together to study children's autism in this context as well.
We are going to thank our speaker again. Thank you very much.